I'm here to talk about the seven deadly sins of documentation. So without further ado, let's get started. First of all, I want to thank my generous employer. Our mission is connecting people with great local businesses. And if you'd like to work on that, talk to me later. So just to start off, I want to talk a little bit about why documentation matters so much to me. Before I came to Yelp, I had generally worked with much smaller teams of five or six people with a much more traditional infrastructure. And by contrast, Yelp is much more on the cutting edge. We use a lot of containers with a custom-built services framework, microservices framework, and a much larger distributed operations team in London and San Francisco primarily. And I also have a writing background. In college, I was a creative writing and history major, and I've done a fair bit of freelance writing, most notably for EVA Online. So that's why documentation tends to matter to me, because I'm just generally interested in writing. Before I start off on talking about the seven deadly sins, like, who thinks they have good docs? Okay, well, that's about what I expected. You're certainly not alone if you don't think you have good docs. GitHub's 2017 open source survey said that 93% of open source projects think their documentation is insufficient, and I've never worked at a workplace where we've been like, yes, our docs are great. So that's understandable if you don't feel super confident in yours. But, you know, why are docs important? To start off, onboarding is a lot easier if your documentation is up to snuff. You don't have to handhold a new employee through everything. Lets them get up to speed quickly and build their confidence and independence. It's important for preserving institutional knowledge if somebody leaves, or if you just don't go back to a project for years, and then somebody comes back and tries to figure out what's going on. It's important for incident response. At 3 a.m., you don't really want to be relying on your memory or oral tradition passed down through the ages to figure out why something's broken. It's also really important for inclusiveness. GitHub mentions this in regard to open source, but for organizations, documents provide a way to state your values, to promote a culture, and encourage involvement. And it shows you value bringing new people into your organization. Good documentation perpetuates good documentation. If people see good docs, they're more likely to trust them, and therefore, when they write them, they'll write them with the mind that somebody's going to be reading these at some point. Whereas if nobody trusts your documentation and nobody writes your documentation, it just sort of withers on the vine, and it perpetuates a bad state. But if we all seem to think that documentation is important, but so few of us think that our documentation is good, like, why does it just not get done? And the real root of all the problems I'm going to talk about in this talk is deprioritization. And, you know, what do I mean by this? Just in general, documentation is seen as extra work. It's not necessary work. It's seen as something that anyone can do. It doesn't require any sort of special skill. Or it's just something that'll kind of happen on its own over the course of the project because people will make notes or, you know, tell people what to do. Why don't we prioritize it, though? And it's not necessarily for bad reasons. Young organizations can be really busy, and it just kind of gets pushed to the side because pushing out that product is more important. You can have a fast-moving organization where things are changing all the time, and documentation is really hard to keep up to date if the things you're documenting are changing every week. And I think probably where a lot of it comes from, documentation isn't the interesting part of this job for a lot of people. I'm kind of a special case where I really like writing, but a lot of other people, they'd much rather be writing code or, you know, trying to figure out a new way to do infrastructure. And when we don't prioritize documentation, what happens? Often we'll think we'll go back and document it later, and that just doesn't end up happening because something else will come up, or we go back to document it and we can't remember what we did. There's a tendency to see documentation as lesser work. It's not the same as writing code or designing infrastructure, so we don't tend to hold it to the same standards. Documentation will get dumped on new or junior members of the team, and these people can lack the context to really understand why decisions were made or how things work in relation to other parts of the infrastructure they're not familiar with. And then it ends up being a lot of like cut and paste and sort of, you know, not really done in a way that helps understand the system that they're documenting. The bad problem is if you don't see writing as part of your job, you just won't do it enough to get better at it. Professional writers will tell you you don't get better at writing without actually doing writing, and you wouldn't expect somebody to get better at programming without actually writing code. That's important. And that really means that all the things we do to make our code and our infrastructure better, it's not done with documentation, so it languishes. So how do we get out of that? It's pretty simple. Documentation isn't extra work. It's necessary work. You can't have good documentation unless you treat it like any other task. And what does that mean? It means documentation needs to be a deliverable. It needs to be included in project plans. People need to get time to complete it, and they need to be held accountable for producing it. Nobody is told that this is something that they're expected to do, it's not going to get done, and you can't really blame them for that. I don't want to spend a ton of time at work doing things I'm not going to get credit for. You should make a documentation standard and a style guide. A lot of us will have this for code, but nobody's got something like this for documentation, at least in engineering organizations, because I guarantee you that most of your marketing departments probably have something like this. And what it has to be in that, I'll talk about a little later, but it doesn't need to be making everybody read the Elements of Style or the Chicago Manual of Style or like the AP Style Guide, but you should provide some references for proper language and grammar. You should call out common mistakes when writing documentation, like using passive voice or overuse of ambiguous modifiers, like pretty or most or good, or don't make documents too long. If your documents are too long, like it's really hard for people to absorb that information or find that information on the page. And another element of any style guide should probably be notes on accessibility, like using alt text for graphics. You should have a real review process for your documentation. That's just like most people do for code. And in contrast to what I said before about writing docs, having new or junior members of the team review your documentation is often a really good idea. They don't have that context, so they need to absorb that from the documentation you're writing. So, you know, they come in with the fewest assumptions, and they're going to depend the most on those documents. So if they're reviewing it and they think it's good and they understand what you want them to understand, like that's a good sign for your documentation. But most importantly, everybody has to write documentation. It can't just be one person's job. They can't possibly understand all the details of your infrastructure, and they can't understand all the context in which decisions were made. So sharing that burden will give everybody practice writing and makes it clear that having good docs is something you expect everybody to provide, as opposed to it's that person's job. The other ones I want to talk about all generally come from deprioritizing docs, but just really quick, it's burying the lead, documentation overgrowth, repository overload, comment neglect, jargon overuse, and video addiction. So to start off, I want to talk about burying the lead, or also I call it the master of none. Have you ever had to read a long and detailed document to try and figure out what an alert means? Or tried to figure out how two systems relate to each other based on what alerts they're throwing? Like, this is bearing the lead. Like, different situations call for different types of documentation. In operations, we generally have two major types of docs, runbooks and technical docs. When we're in the middle of an incident, we need runbooks that tell us how to address immediate problems to get things back up and running right away. But when we're trying to understand our infrastructure, we need a document that thoroughly describes how it works and what it interacts with so we can build a mental model of that system. But unfortunately, it's a common problem that we either have one or the other, or we have one giant document that tries to do both and ends up doing neither well. To put this in a more concrete way, you wouldn't start telling someone how to fix a tire by starting out with how a car is manufactured. And you wouldn't try and describe how a car is built by telling somebody how to fix a tire, or change a fan belt, or replace a taillight. So when you're writing runbooks, you want to answer specific questions about how to know what's wrong and what to do about it. So you can link to these answers from alerts, so they're easy to find at 3 a.m. when you wake up. You want to make sure that they're clear and well written that way. You want to use the inverted pyramid format. This is something from journalism where you put the most important or commonly used information at the top of the page and then sort of work your way down to the stuff that's, you know, less common or less important. You can sort of get around this with a table of contents, but that's sort of it's not a great pattern to fall into, so you want to work towards that inverted pyramid format. You want to make sure that any example commands you have in your runbook are benign. Tanya Riley talked a little about this at a talk she had at LISA a couple years ago, where they had a example command that deleted a user, and it used the CEO's actual username in it, and somebody actually ran that command, and it ended poorly. So don't do that. If you want to give an explanation about why these steps work, it shouldn't be more than a sentence or two in the runbook. If you want to give a more detailed explanation, you should link to some other document that explains how this works in detail. And when you review a runbook, you want to make sure you actually try the steps given in it. You don't want to find out in the middle of an incident that, oh, that doesn't actually work. One of my favorite, like, public runbooks is Oh Shit, Git by Katie Seiler Miller. It lays out a number of specific problems you can run into with Git and gives you the commands to fix them. Each one has a very short explanation of why it works and what it's doing. And the questions are all laid out in a conscious order. At the top, you've got, I need to roll back my last change, which is probably the most common thing you'll run into. And at the bottom is nuke it from orbit and start from scratch. For technical documentation, this is things like specs, guides, references. There's a lot of different names for them. But you want to provide context on why the things are the way they are. You know, why did you make it work this way? This stuff is easily lost if it's not written down, especially because it's usually done like in somebody's head or in a discussion somewhere. So you need to preserve that context. You want to provide concrete example for how things function. One of the documents I made relatively recently was about how a new load balancer that we've developed works. And, you know, I gave specific numbers with regard to, like, traffic. And, like, here's how this functions when traffic is balanced in this way. And here's how it functions when traffic is balanced this way. By doing that, like, it's much easier for people to understand how it works or to apply theory to practice. You also want to know who you're writing for. That's especially the case for these kinds of docs. A high-level overview shouldn't assume a lot of previous specific knowledge, since it'll be probably one of the first things that people use when they're trying to learn about that system for the first time. But something that's more in detail can probably assume that they've read, like, the upper-level docs. Don't rely on auto-generated documentation generally. It's not really formatted for human consumption most of the time. I think the only time I've seen this work okay is with, like, API reference. Generally, everything else just ends up being not great. Let me just put it that way. The other thing you want to do is make sure you don't send people down a rabbit hole. If you've ever like browsed Wikipedia for like 3 hours or TV tropes, like don't do that to people. If you need to link to other documentation, that's great, but you should probably give a short summary of the stuff you want them to pull out of that document first, so that they only need to go into that if they really need more detail. And lastly, you want to have the person reviewing your docs like tell you what they understood from that, because you want to make sure that what they pulled out of it is what you wanted them to understand. Generally, it all comes down to making your intent clear. If you want to prefix document titles with like what type of document they are, like that's an idea. Like at Yelp, we preface all our run books with run book, blah. If you want to break down those document categories further, you can do that. At Yelp, we have run books and how to's, which are both sort of types of run books. And if you want to make it explicit, you can have an audience statement at the top of the document, like this is for new hires, or this is for people who, you know, have never worked with X before. Generally, I find that's actually better for the person writing the document, so they can keep that in mind. But you know, it's also good for the person reading it to understand, like, hey, is this really for me? Whatever you do, you want to make sure all of your documents have a specific purpose in mind and a specific audience in mind so that it can be addressed narrowly at that. Repository overload is the next one I want to talk about. If you've got stuff in a wiki and in a Google Docs and then some in email and you've also got it in a Git repo, this is probably what you're suffering from. If you have all of these different repos, how does someone know where to find the documents they're looking for? Or where should they put the documents they write? If they don't know that, they'll just sort of put them wherever they can find or wherever they feel like it, and it perpetuates this problem. It also makes incidents last longer because people are spending all this time looking for the documentation they need, and if they can't find it, they're going to try and roust a subject matter expert from bed. And that's going to lead to burnout if people are getting woke up all the time because the system that they wrote broke and it's not documented. So just in general, the worst docs are the ones no one can find, which seems obvious. So to put this back in order, you know, how can we fight this? Well, first, you want to have as few documentation repositories as possible. One or two is optimal. If you do have more than one, you need to make sure the purpose of each of them is well understood. Define it in that style guide. So if you want to keep your general documentation in a wiki, because it's better for that, and you want to keep your run books in Google Docs, because during an incident you don't want them to disappear, that's fine. But make sure everybody understands you put your run books in Google Docs, you put everything else in a wiki. If you need to duplicate them, you want to do this in an automated way because having two places to edit it is going to mean that they drift apart, and that will be really bad if you have an incident and somebody looks at the wrong copy. Whatever repository you use for your docs, you want to make sure it keeps track of changes and it's searchable at a bare minimum. But sometimes you won't know what to search for, or you know, that's not going to make it obvious what you're looking for. So that's why discoverability is also important. This is really where I feel like Google Docs does not really work. In a wiki, you can sort of see that structure, and that means like, oh, here's a puppet doc. It's right next to these other puppet docs. So if I'm looking for that, like, I know where to go. As a special note, email, chat logs, and tickets are not good primary documentation sources. They're ephemeral, and they're hard for people coming in after the fact to really understand or find. So they can be good for notifying people or pointing them to the actual docs, but they shouldn't be repositories in and of themselves. So next I want to talk about documentation overgrowth. Do you have a lot of docs that say obsolete, do not use at the top? Or have you run into a situation where you have three different docs that all contradict each other about how something works? That's documentation overgrowth. And how do we get that? Generally the same way you get regular overgrowth. Nobody's tending the garden. No one goes back to update documentation, so you get drift. The map goes even further from the territory, and no one really trusts that the documentation describes reality. Sometimes we'll update our docs and keep the old ones around just in case. And this can lead to confusion and clutter searches. Even if old docs are marked obsolete, you'll end up having to jump through extra hoops just to find the information that you're looking for. And again, new or junior team members are going to be bitten by this the most because they tend to be the ones who depend on your documentation the most. But everybody's going to fall into this trap, especially at 3 a.m. when you're paged about an incident. So fighting back against this, you know, the best thing you can do is make sure that documentation is a priority for you. Make sure that delivering documentation is a specific goal of your projects and not just something you hope gets done. When we're doing that, also don't keep your old docs around. If you need to go back and find something, that's why I say keep that change history. Pull the things you need out of your old docs and just toss the rest. If you insist on keeping them around, make sure they're archived in such a way that they won't clutter searches and make it harder to find the actual current docs. You can put them in a PDF and throw it in S3, or put it in some other code repository. Just don't make it so it's going to be confused with your actual documentation. But just in general, the best way to keep your docs up to date is to make sure you're using and updating them regularly. If you make it easy to find and easy to update your documentation, people are more likely to do it, and the better your documentation will be, so that sort of creates that virtuous circle. It's one of the reasons why I tend to like WYSIWYG editors, just because it makes that barrier to entry pretty low. If you're not using your docs, you won't know what to update, and if you're not updating them, people will be less likely to use them, so it's that vicious circle. And I would say resist the temptation to designate like a documentation week. Like at the end of this quarter, we're going to go back and document everything we've done. The problem with that is it will get pushed off because some other crisis will come up. And even if it does happen, until it gets done, your documents are out of date. And that's not a great situation to be in. Comment neglect. Do you have a 500-line Puppet manifest with no comments? Do you have comments that reference tickets from two ticketing systems ago? Especially as someone whose programming skills are not the strongest, comment neglect is really frustrating. A lot of times I hear the code is the documentation. And within reason, you know, that part of that's true. Like if your code is laid out well, if you have obvious variable names, like yes, it's easier to figure out what's going on. You should make your code as straightforward and obvious in its intent as you can without comments. But knowing what code is doing is very different from knowing why it's doing what it does. So you need to add comments to your code. Reading code without context is really difficult. When you come back to your code 6 months or a year later, or if somebody else is coming to it fresh, like they won't have that context. You want to make sure that they understand why you made the decisions you did and what pitfalls lurk ahead of them before they start doing their bug fixing or adding features. When we're in the middle of writing our code, like it's also easy to lose perspective. If you've been focused on something for weeks, it's going to seem a lot more intuitive to you than it actually is. This is one of the reasons why writers rarely depend on our own proofreading for, you know, editing. Not everyone is as fluent in the language you're using as you are either. For instance, at Yelp, like we use a lot of Python, but Puppet uses a variety of Ruby, and we have Golang code for Terraform providers, and that's a lot of bases to cover, and it's not always obvious how parts of our Terraform code stitch together, for instance. So using comments makes it more obvious about how all those things tie together. So here's some examples of better comments. Like, see this page for context on why we use this method, and then a pointer to your wiki. Or say something like, optimally we'd hit the API, but last time we did that, we got throttled, so that's why we hit the cache. Or, you know, this configuration file sets up the endpoint for US West. See this other file if you want to see how it figures into the overall weighting for our load balancer or whatever. So just in general, good comments are about providing context. And whether we're documenting it outside the code or inside the code, like, we want to make sure that's clear. So make sure your code is understandable and is clear what it's supposed to be doing and why. If you're documenting a how in the comments of your code, though, you want to make sure that you're updating that if you change the method it's actually using, or better yet, just you don't need to put that in a comment. Just make it clear in your code, like, how something works. But do put in, like, how did I decide to do this? Put it in the comments or in accompanying documentation. And to reiterate what I said before about technical documents, providing concrete examples of how things are supposed to behave so that people can build mental models is really helpful. And with other, as I said about other documentation, have people with less familiarity with that code review it, because you want them to make sure they can understand it and why. Jargon overuse. Like, if it takes people new to your group 2 months to figure out what anybody is talking about, like, this is what you're falling into, probably. It's only natural for small groups to develop jargon as shorthand, especially in a new or small organization. Services get named because, like, somebody thought the name sounded cool, or like it was an in-joke. At Yelp, for instance, we call our incidents DARS, because the ticket type shorthand is shorthand for Darwin, who is the CEO's dog. Like, when the company started and, like, ate an Ethernet cable, and that caused a site outage. But, like, for somebody who doesn't have any of that context, if your documentation talks about DARS everywhere, like, they're going to be a little confused for a bit. So this kind of thing is great for building team cohesion when you're starting out, or, you know, when you have a small team, but as your organization grows, it starts to be a problem. Every time you bring a new person on, they have to learn all of these new terms. And that cultural shorthand, which was great at pulling people together before, now it becomes the barrier between the in-group and the out-group. And this might not be a problem if you're still small and you can, you know, bring them into the culture some other way. But when your organization gets bigger, like, that barrier just keeps getting higher and higher. It's also an impediment to just, like, learning the system, because it's not immediately obvious what the various parts are or how they relate to each other. Unless you have that inherent knowledge. And for those of us that tend to suffer from imposter syndrome, like me, this jargon can make that even worse. It's hard to know what is something you should know and what's something that's like a new specific term to whatever this organization is you're walking into. And like asking that question is really intimidating, especially if it's the first couple of weeks at this new company. It makes that dichotomy between in-group and the out-group even worse. So fighting back against that, the easy way to do that is just don't use jargon. Like, if there's a name for something that isn't jargon, like, use that other term. Like, we use incidents in our documentation, or we are now, instead of DAR, because we don't want to make that just unintelligible for the sake of making it unintelligible. If you need to use shorthand acronyms, you want to make sure the first time you use it, like, you define what that acronym means. And like I've mentioned before, keep your audience in mind. Sometimes you might need to provide more basic information in your docs than you usually would if you were just explaining to someone, especially if the audience is new people or people outside your team. This is another case where exact command lines and good examples can help give some extra context. They'll make it easier for people to figure out what you're talking about. This next one is kind of a, like, giving up, it feels like, but yes, a glossary is an okay idea. It's something that people can consult at least, but you don't want to use it as a crutch. Like, make sure it provides enough context and links to other documentation that people can feel fully confident that they know what you're talking about. And above all else, like, you want to try and cultivate an inclusive environment where people feel like they can ask, like, the stupid questions. Because it'll help break down that barrier between the in-group and the out-group. This is really easier said than done, and I'm sure it's worth at least an entire talk or an entire conference in and of itself. So this really isn't something you can count on, but like it's something you should aspire to at the very least. The last thing I want to talk about is video addiction. And this is something that we've kind of fallen into a trap with at Yelp. And we're trying to pull ourselves out of it. So if you know anything about online publications, like a couple years ago, everybody was pivoting to video. And that's, you know, there's a lot of people who think that's the solution to their documentation. We can just record this 15-minute presentation, and then we don't have to document anything. There is some merit to video. Like, there's evidence that video is more engaging than text just because you have to pay more attention to it. I will grant that most of this evidence seems to come from video marketers, so take it for what it's worth. But it just does demand more of your attention, so that is, you know, helpful. And sometimes it can be easier to present and explain complex topics in a video than in a flat document, and that tends to be more memorable for people. But video has a lot of other problems when it comes to documentation. How many people here would prefer to read an article over watch a video about something in the news? Yeah. So, like, there's a reason for that. Like, video can't be searched like text can. You don't want to have to watch a half-hour video to find the 30-second chunk that you actually care about, especially if time is the essence. You're probably also less likely to watch that video as frequently as you would read a document, and therefore you lose track of which ones are out of date. Videos aren't as easy to update as text. Like, it takes video editing skills to go back and update that video, or you have to go back and re-record the whole thing from scratch. And a bad edit can make that video unintelligible. In general, what happens is that that video just sits there, gets out of date, and people try to patch the errors by handing down that knowledge via oral tradition, which isn't great. Videos aren't great for accessibility either. People with dyslexia can often learn things better from a video, but video and graphics really don't work great for people who need to use screen readers. Videos also need to have subtitles for hearing impaired folks, and if you use the auto-generated captions on YouTube, you know that that's not really a panacea either. So you'll have to write that down in a text format anyway, so why not just make an actual document that people can read? So if you are going to use video, it shouldn't be your primary documentation method, to say the very least. It's an okay supplement. It's well-suited to things which need to be viewed in their entirety and are updated infrequently, like general onboarding or overviews of your infrastructure. But realize if you're doing that, regardless of how infrequently it changes, you're still committing to putting in the effort to keep it up to date when things do change. And if you can't, you know, do that, don't rely on video. If you use a lot of graphics or use any graphics, you should always have descriptive alt text in them. Avoid cramming a document with too many pictures, because if your document is 20 screenshots long, it's really hard for people to find stuff in there. And if you are going to make videos, add timestamps for, like, hey, if you want to find out about this subject, we talk about it at 105 in this video. And you also want to make sure you provide accurate subtitles. And if you're going to provide accurate subtitles, you also might as well just include an entire transcript. And that makes it easier for people to search and find, you know, a small snippet of information that they're looking for. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about what we've done at Yelp since I gave a version of this talk at LISA last year. It's been an interesting sort of journey. Last year, during November or December, I wrote a sort of style guide out of frustration with our documentation situation after the talk I gave. And I just sort of started talking to people about it and sort of socializing it. This is the sort of stuff I stuck in it. I decided, like, let's just decide that the wiki is going to be our authoritative source for all our docs, which eliminates a lot of the confusion, like, where, what goes where? And this was not really decided by Fiat. I talked about this with a lot of people and sort of we developed a consensus. I gave some guidelines for creating discoverable titles, like put distinguishing features towards the front of the title so they don't get cut off in Confluence's sidebar. Like write load balancer configuration as opposed to configuring load balancers. We clearly defined what types of documents we would have. We decided we'd have topical guides, which is like system overviews or documentation of technical decisions, how-tos, which were descriptions of common tasks, and runbooks for diagnosing and remediating issues with the system or service. I also add some general writing tips, like a lot of the things I've done in this talked about in this talk. And I also link to our brand style guide, which is something that our marketing department makes, I think, which talks about here's how we use these terms that are company specific. And it also had a lot of like, here's some common writing mistakes, or here's what you should do when you're writing. I also link to a lot of other documentation resources, like the talks and articles I have linked at the end of this talk. And that gave people a base to sort of start building on. Eventually, there was enough consensus that, hey, this was something we should work on, that it became, like, a major project for the team last quarter. I guess technically still last quarter. We created tickets for major documentation subgroups, split up by subject, like all our Puppet documentation, our Terraform documentation, our package management documentation. That ended up not being broken down far enough. The chunks were still a little too big, so we went back and chopped that up further. I took a lot of the biggest parts because I felt strongest about it, and I had been there for a while, so now I had enough context to sort of work on the high-level docs. And we had a discussion over whether we wanted to, was our goal to move everything into Confluence, or was our goal to, take those documents, make sure they were revised, and consolidate them. We didn't really answer that definitively at the beginning, and I think that kind of fed into some of the places where we fell short. It was kind of a mixed bag. It was much more time-consuming than a lot of us expected. Even just revising documentation takes a lot of time, let alone doing a significant rewrite. Reviews can be difficult to get. Finalizing documents, I really wanted a review by a subject matter expert, but these people tend to be the busiest people on the team, too. And kind of our impatience and, confusion about what our goals actually were led to some mismatched expectations. And in the end, we ended up moving a lot of documents straight from Google Docs to the wiki. And that had the advantage, now it was really all the documents we were looking for were in one place. But it also meant that a lot of the searches were cluttered with older, outdated docs. However, it really was worth it. Just writing that style guide kind of helped get the ball rolling, and it gave us something to focus the discussion on. Whereas before, a lot of people felt like our documentation wasn't really up to snuff, but nobody had really thought about what we could do about it in a sort of a focused way. Lately, a lot of people outside the operations group have started to ask me about it and are trying to bring that into their team. A lot of our most used documents got moved over and updated, making it a focus of the team got me specifically and other people time to allocate towards overhauling our documents. And there's been good feedback from people both inside and outside the group over the change in quality. I also focused on our onboarding documentation, and a lot of our more recent hires who didn't have that when they started were like, oh, hey, this would have been great a year ago. And we have a couple new hires starting now, and I'm really looking forward to their feedback. And even this first step made people realize how much better documentation can be, and it's helped buy capital for doing more documentation work in the future. So just in general, how can we enter a documentation state of grace? And here's what we can do. We can have runbooks, we can have in-depth technical docs, but not do them in the same place. Like, we can store our documents in one or two repositories, make sure they keep a history, they're easily searchable, and easily updated. Update them frequently and don't clutter them with old docs. We can provide plenty of context in our code comments, avoid jargon where we can, and define it where we can't, and be wary of overusing video and graphics. But most importantly, we should realize that documentation isn't extra work, it's necessary work. We need to make sure that having good docs is prioritized just like having good code or resilient infrastructure, and that means we need to treat it the same way we do that stuff. Like, make sure everyone sees it as their job, make sure it's reviewed, and make sure it's seen as a deliverable. Without that, you're really going to have a hard time getting the rest of this done. So that's all I have to say. We're hiring. If anybody's interested, find me after the talk. Here's all our social media business. And I've included this list of references. When the slides go up, it'll be there. But that should give you stuff to go on. So that's really all I have, and I think we're out of time. So,
does anybody have any questions? Oh, sorry. There you go.
Hey, thanks for the talk. You already mentioned glossaries and this internal terms, for example, for the incident tickets. My experience is actually paramount to actually get rid of this kind of stupid internal names in the first place. So, how do you approach this? So instead of getting rid only of this internal namings of the company in your documentation, but really getting rid of this naming in the first place, because otherwise you still have to look it up what it means in your ticket system.
I don't know if I have good advice on that. I'm trying to think. So you're just asking, like, how do you come up with names that are intuitive?
So I think it's kind of one thing is from top down. Okay, you cannot have stupid names for your microservices or whatever. So I think this is actually helps. Then you don't have this problem with glossary and so on.
Yeah, I think to some extent, a lot of this has to be sort of have the management stamp of approval. Like, this is a priority for us, and I think that's the case with like jargon too. Like, we need to make sure the service is not named after somebody's cat and it has no context. But I don't know how you do that without that, like, other than like socializing it as a value that you have, which, like, cultural change is the hardest part of any sort of change. And I've certainly found that to be the case. I don't have any easy answers for you there, I guess.
Just gotta jump onto the next one because we're pretty short on time, so.
Question on overlapping documentation. How do you recognize overlaps and how do you deal with it?
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Overlapping documentation.
That's like difficult. I think part of it is you need to have people like going back through and actually curating those documents on a regular basis. Or like, hey, if somebody notices that there's a duplicate doc, like, file a ticket or find some way to like create work off of that. It's one of those things where you have to have people like become intolerant of a problem. Sort of like, oh, I get alerted by this alert every night, but it just like goes off. Like, it fixes itself. It's not that big a deal. Like, people will just become immune to that and ignore it. Like, you have to sort of break them out of that complacency. And I think you have to do the same thing with, like, bad docs. Like, a lot of people be like, oh, this command line's not quite right. I figured out the right one. I'll just do that. Like, you can't, like, tolerate that. You have to either people say, all right, I'm going to make that commitment to update the doc or delete the old doc, but, not just ignore it.
Okay, thanks.
I think this is our last question here.
Thank you for a great presentation. So my question will be, what's your experience with creating of like some documentation framework? But pretty much who should own that part in some enterprise organization, and what are your guidelines there?
Like a technical framework?
Like a framework which is like how to make your tutorials, how to document your stuff, what for should you use runbooks, what for should you use how-tos, and, you know, like set of the rules. And when you are delivering documentation, what should be captured?
I think a lot of it comes down to, like, at least on the writing part, like, the style guide is sort of the key to sort of creating that. Also, like, if you feel strongly about it and you want to start off that project, like, I found a lot of people will, like, if they have an example to go by, like, that's really helpful. I'm finding that with a lot of our documents, too. Like, I'm doing our postmortem stuff now and, like, trying to revamp that process, and a lot of people are like, hey, if we had an example postmortem to go by, like, that would be really helpful. And I think for a lot of people, that's super handy to have something like that, just stuff they can count on, like, this was written according to the style guide, it sort of lays out stuff. And that's sort of part of that self-perpetuating thing I talk about, where if you have good documentation, people also feel like they're held to that standard or have something where they can see that standard.
Excellent. That was our last question. Thank you so much, Shushastri.